When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Vicky Fleetwood, and you're listening to the Mall Over Rugby Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Mall Over Podcast. The only rugby podcast gives you the news, views and opinion on the weekend's rugby action, all with a West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter, we are at Mall Over Podcast, and you can find all of our content on the Sports Podcast Network. This week, as we head into another fallow week of the Six Nations, I am joined by nicest man in Cornish Rugby Podcasting, Ben Eustace. How you doing, Ben?
Hello.
And not everyone's favourite, the housewife's favourite, certainly. Phil Farvet, Phil Elkins, how you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. If there's any delay or background noise, it's because my idiot children have decided half eight's the right time to make pancakes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I'm muting myself as much as possible.
Love it. I wouldn't worry about it, mate. We have lots of background noise in general. So where are we in relation to the Six Nations? We're three games deep. We've had the first fallow week. Then we're back because it feels like 2 weeks. Like 2 weeks ago is when I went to Twickenham with Samuel for the Italy game, which we didn't actually reconvene afterwards. That was a good day out. Kib was absolutely buzzing from 6 o'clock in the morning till approximately 6:30 when we finally started to get moving outside of Twickenham. And by the time we reached the motorway, he was asleep and that was it. Absolute crash.
Did the Haskell set take it out of him?
Oh, I mean, if there was a bigger waste of time throughout that entire day, I don't know what it was. We spent a bit of time, you know, when you watch the coach come in, have you seen the coach come down the approach, the way when it gets to the gates and all the players get off and everyone's there waiting and taking photographs and stuff of the coach. So we're stood there for, you know, about half an hour. There's loads of kind ladies wandering around with sort of large shot glasses of free Guinness Zero, which I'm not going to lie, isn't the most horrific thing I've ever tasted. And as I was driving, I made full use of Guinness Zero just to get into the spirit. Anyway, so we waited there for about 20 minutes or so, thinking, oh, the coach will be here in a minute, and everyone started to line up and think, oh, this is great. And Sam goes, oh, I need a wee. Says, all right, no problem, mate. Let's go for a wee. Can you guess what happened next?
They all came in.
They all came in. Right in the point he was having a wee.
Not into the arrival, I'm assuming.
Just missed it all. He missed the whole coach arrival. They'd all got off, like, they were all, by the time we got back, like, the streets were empty and everyone was sort of crowded around the back of the bus with their phones in the air trying to take photographs of the guys getting the bags off the coach.
You should have gotten to have a piss on the wheels of the coach.
Well, yeah.
I'm glad you said that he got in the car and then crashed, and not he got in the car and then you crashed, because that would have been a whole different journey back. Samuel, you're driving.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been ideal. But it was a great day out. Twickenham, there was a decent enough atmosphere. Lots of drunk people. And I know that was highlighted previously, and I'm not complaining about it because, you know, I'm fully aware of what goes on, and I'm not, you know, not too bothered by it. But there were lots of drunk people. There was a guy sat almost directly behind us that every time he got up to either go to the bar or go to the toilet, nearly fell on top of us because he was that drunk.
I do think
worse than normal, or because I haven't been for a few years, and there's always been alcohol around, like most people in fairly good control of themselves, and the odd fool who's taken it too far.
That's pretty much what it was.
Yeah. I do think like it wouldn't do any harm to close the bar during the game.
During the game, I think would make the most sense. Like, yeah. open it five, you know.
Half time and then open it again yeah. 5 minutes after the game. I don't think yeah. it'd do any harm.
It's enough of a bun fight to get beer at half time. You've got to give yourself a 5 minute window yeah. in the middle yeah. of the game. There's a penalty or a head injury or something. You're like, right, I'm going to go and get a pint.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, most people have had, what, four, five before they've even got into the ground. So,
yeah,
you know, a break during the game probably does everyone a good world of good.
Yeah. And if there's a stadium that's more awkward to get away from than Twickenham. Yeah. It, honestly, we did a just park outside the exclusion zone. I mean, this is boring for the listening public, but you know, we did a just park outside of like the cordoned off exclusion zone, and it was just gridlock. And every way we turned, every way that I tried to go, and it, even to the point where I went north to try and get to Hounslow and get on the M4, and it just wasn't having it at all. It's just a nightmare.
This is Pete Partridge chat.
Pete Partridge. Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about some rugby. Since England lost to Scotland in that opening game, obviously they've beaten Italy and they've beaten Wales now. And it's got me thinking that, you know, barring a couple of, say, individual errors, England could legitimately be three for three. In this tournament. I mean, they're not, but they could be. They weren't horrific against Scotland, were they? There was some horrific bits that we already talked about. But they could legitimately be three from three. Going into Italy and going into France and Ireland. Since that first game, Ben, what have you made of the changes? Because obviously, you know, Smith was put on the bench. And Willis has come back in for both games.
Yeah, well, I think the Farrell move was the move we all wanted in one way or another, of at least putting a 10 in. And I think it's definitely worked because Lawrence has looked good and the shape of the team has looked better. I think Willis is just an upgrade over Ben Curry. So, you know, that makes sense. But England just looked like a team with a new manager who've had 3 extra weeks. I think there were little bits against Scotland where it looked like, you know, they were starting to look okay. And I think they at least look like they know each other now, which under Eddie Jones, they didn't always look like they did. And I think with, you know, there was a lot of issues with the defence in the first game, but it got better in the second game and it was much better against Wales, although Wales didn't offer a lot, did they? But, you know, I think 3 weeks being slightly intimidated by Kevin Sinfield has probably done them the world of good. I mean, you know, for all Wales' limitations, we were pushing them back 15, 20 metres in some of the defensive sets. So you can't really complain about that. But, you know, I think England do look better. They're not the finished article yet. We'll be arguing about the fly half situation for at least the next 12 months, I'm sure. But
at least.
It looks like a rugby team with a plan. You've got a focal point in the centres. You've got a couple of distributors. You've got a back row with sort of clearly defined roles. And I think we have found our second row partnership for the future now.
Cool. Phil?
Yeah, it's really hard to overcomplicate this. Basically, they're playing players in the positions they should be playing. They've got a hard runner outside of 10 that provides an option and commits defences. They've got a 10 who's taking the ball to the line and making decisions. And they're progressing, but it's all based on fairly simple kind of rugby coaching principles. And this has been the frustrating thing about the history of England rugby over the last 5 years, is they've just gone away from stuff that, I mean, Christ, most under-15s coaches would know. If you've got a big bloke running outside your 10, he commits defenders and allows other people to do stuff. And I don't know, there's obviously quite a big difference in opinion. The big talking point after the Wales game is Farrell. So accepting the fact that his kicking is awful and he shouldn't be kicking when you've either got Slade or Smith on the pitch, I thought for the first 30-35 minutes of the Wales game, he was excellent. And I thought for the last 15-20, he was very good as well. And first half of the second half, he reverted back to the old, if we don't make progress in the first phase, we're going to box kick it or kick for territory, and kind of went into his shell a little bit, which I've got to think must have been guided a bit by Borthwick saying, let's just take a bit of control.
Well, bear in mind, sorry to interrupt there, but bear in mind, the first thing that happened in that second half was that the Rhys Sammet interception try. And I know that wasn't his fault specifically. England, that for a little period, that did sort of shell shock England a little bit, didn't it? They weren't quite sure what to do. So they did go into a little bit more of a reserve mode.
Yeah, but they kind of came straight back and scored, didn't they? And then went into their shell, and it was like, okay, well, we're back at square one now. And you know,
but, and even the intercept came off a desire to get the ball wide fairly early on in the phases, which they had no intention of doing against Scotland. But like, it's been chat within our group. So what did he do? He tackled hard. Well, actually, yes, Farrell's defence was as good as I've seen from a 10 for a long time. He put in some really good, hard, strong tackles, turned the ball over four times. But the difference was he was taking the ball to the line and then making really good, well-timed passes that if it was Marcus Smith doing that, people would be absolutely raving about. Like the inside ball for Maylands for the first try, the timing on it was absolutely exceptional. Yes, it was a set play, but it still needs to be delivered on. About 15 minutes from the end, he put in a flat miss pass to Slade right across the front of the Welsh defenders that just absolutely opened them up. And Slade then made the wrong decision and went to kick for the corner. But there were things that you haven't seen from Farrell for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, where just a freedom to take the ball to the line and then make a decision. And yeah, it helps having Lawrence there, and it also helps having forwards that are not at the bottom of a ruck because they've overcommitted to it.
But then that's been a small criticism of Farrell, hasn't it? To being too committed in that area. And I think he made he made something like 17 tackles in the game, and at least one very good turnover. But is that what you want your 10?
Well, he was involved in four turnovers. So he made one turnover himself. I think he got awarded a penalty for holding on. He held up Tompkins at the end, and then there was another one as well. But do you want your 10 to get stuck in D? Yeah, definitely, because that's where the tackles come. The tackles and the turnovers are not coming when we've got the ball, when you want him controlling stuff.
Yeah.
They're coming in defence. And actually, in attack, it was only in that 20 minutes in the second half where I thought he carried into contact when it was the wrong option. He should have looked for someone else to do that work for him. In the first half, he wasn't doing that. He was taking the ball to the line and then giving it to Lawrence or to Genge or whoever.
And I'm okay with that. Go on, Ben, sorry.
I was going to just agree with Phil, really. He definitely overused the kick for probably, I don't know, 30 minutes. And it was quite frustrating. And much as I thought he played well, I think we do need to just have Smith make a run at some stage, you know, with the stabilizers off, you know, without Farrell. But whether that is in the friendlies before the World Cup or if it's in the Six Nations, I don't know. I doubt it'll be in the Six Nations while they keep winning. So if they do somehow beat France, which is a possibility at home, then I think it will just stay as it is. But, you know, I don't know if we want to get into him being sent home to his club for the next training.
We'll let Phil come in on his point, and then maybe we'll chat about that briefly.
Yeah, so I just wanted to say there was a lot of talk about the substitutions or the lack of use of substitutions on Saturday. Now, for me, I think if England were 20 points up after 50, 60 minutes, I think he brings Smith on potentially for Farrell and gives him a run. Agreed. The problem was we were playing pretty well. We were certainly dominating Wales, and the scoreline wasn't reflecting that. Now, if you make a change, it could all go belly up. And the same thing with Arundel, not bringing him on. The back three, I thought, played really well. You've got a back three who are playing well. Do you want to change that when you're only, whatever it was, 10 points ahead? Probably not.
Well, we weren't even 10 points ahead, were we?
No, you're right, yeah.
We were
five points up. 5 points, yeah.
Talking of substitutions, the one that really did work was bringing Mitchell on.
Yeah. Because he's impressed me. The two games he's come off the bench, he's really.
I thought Van Portfleet had one of his better games for England, and I thought he was another one that defended really well. He put four or five like open field tackles that you thought were Farrell, but it was him. But he kind of went the same way as Farrell, and he kind of went back to chipping and taking too long. And I thought when Mitchell came on, like I was watching the game with Monkey Dave, Hornets legend and scrum half, and he straight away was like, oh, he's got a lovely pass. So, you know, and I think that's the first sort of thing you look for in a number nine, even now, is quality of service. And it just sped up as soon as he came on. And part of that's probably Wales tiring, but I thought he looked really good.
So I'd agree with that. And I've seen some criticisms, right? So I've seen criticisms of Farrell from, you know, the rugby websites, the people all over social media that like to potentially cause a bit of controversy. But 4 out of 10 for Farrell, which I thought was unbelievable, really. Yeah, all right, he missed a few goal kicks. And I think that is something we've mentioned, and he was renowned for his goal kicking ability for quite some time, wasn't it? And his goal kicking hasn't been at the level it should have been for quite a while now for England. And had he kicked his goals, I mean, England would have been, you know, quite a few more points up than he missed a couple of penalties in a conversion in the first half.
But that's a really easy thing to remedy.
Of course it is. It's just one of those things. Like goal kickers do go through dips in form, and Farrell is in one of those kind of troughs at that moment. Another criticism was of Van Portfleet, who said that, you know, whilst he did certain bits okay, Wales then targeted him under the high ball, at which he struggled. I mean, I'm pretty sure that he probably found himself underneath one once. The only time Freddie Stewart wasn't underneath the high ball.
I mean, yeah, they were only targeting one man. Yeah,
well, exactly.
Really didn't
I mean,
work.
And let's be honest, right? If they were targeting that one man, it was one of the worst ploys in international rugby history, because Freddie Stewart absolutely dominated every single aerial. But I mean, I think he missed one. He may have knocked one on, which was a difficult one. But on the whole, he was, you know, imperious in his high ball efforts. And again, like we've mentioned it already, England in general, I thought, were pretty good without being great. But for context, I don't think I've seen as bad a Wales team since I don't know when. Now, the two young centres were okay, but they're inexperienced. The husk and rotting carcass of Alan Wynne-Jones, I mean, well, let's not even go into that. We've mentioned that more than once. The person who surprised me the most, I mean, Faletau didn't have his best game, other than he charged down Farrell in the first half, didn't he? But he wasn't his usual dominant self around the breakdown. The person that surprised me the most was Tipperick. I just thought he's
at a nick, isn't he?
He's really at a nick. He looked laboured. He was, you know, he didn't really, you know, his breakdown work is as good at his best, is as good as there is in the world, and he didn't get near it.
So obviously the Wales team have got this thing hanging over them with contracts and changing rules and regulations and the weakening of the Gatland law that now allows Jake Ball to come back and Hadley Park.
Jake Ball, Corey Hill and
Hadley Park. So the only three players that it affects. So obviously they're going to rescue Wales.
They're really glad they dropped it to 25 caps.
Yeah. But there's something about a team that, like, Gatland's big thing, brings back Alan Wynne-Jones, brings back Faletau, brings back Tipperick. After one game, bins all three of them. And then after the next game, brings them all back. That screams somebody who's not happy with the squad and doesn't really know, hasn't got the players and the talent to achieve what he wants to achieve or feels like that. And like, I never thought I'd say this on this pod, but I'm going to credit Sam Lahner here. He's done a bit of research and looked into passes with deception. So he's termed a pass with deception as something where there's a late tip or a pass out the back or an offload. So something just a bit different and not a straightforward pass. And bearing in mind, that's not even saying they're successful. And the examples that he's clipped up on Twitter of four of these things from Wales are the least deceptful passes out the back or late tips that
deceitful?
You could possibly
deceitful?
See.
Deceptive.
There you go. Yeah. And Wales did 22 of those passes in the game. They did 9 in the first half, which basically means that in attack, they are entirely predictable. And when you've got a defence that, as Ben said, has probably had 3 weeks of Kevin Sinfield shouting at them and properly tearing into them, that are fired up, and all you're doing is you're making entirely predictable passes, you're not going to get anywhere. Unless you've got roid-infused South Africans playing for you, which Wales haven't. I think they're missing the trick and need to start copying Scotland in that regard. But it was just so predictable.
A bit like England, Smith.
A bit like England used to be. Yeah, exactly. Entirely predictable, but also with a back row that's massively out of form, you're going to lose the ball. It's really quite shocking. I can see Wales very easily getting beaten by Italy, and I can see them very easily going through this being nilled. And like, we know how much of a farce the world rankings are. If Wales lose to Italy, they're down to 13th in the world.
That'd be delightful. But
it would.
There was a couple of periods, a couple of passages of play, especially the middle end of that first half on Saturday, where they did enjoy a few phases. They did, but they just seemed to completely run out of steam and ideas. And I think there was a couple of turnovers, you know, maybe 5 meters out from the English line, maybe one just before half time and another maybe about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
After they built a lot of pressure. But they just, instead of keeping it tight and going through the phases, they tried to be a bit quick, and they just didn't have the firepower to get at England. And without that interception try, they did not look like scoring at any point in that match.
Not only that, the 3 points they got as well, the penalty that they got was entirely from a tactic that Saracens use all the time. And I'm so glad the two Saracens players got called up for it, where a player catches the ball, gets tackled really softly, and then the first two players just flop over the top of it. England gifted them all 10 points, and they didn't look like scoring a single point of their own.
Yeah, which has got to be a real concern for Gatland. And, you know, makes me really, really pleasing. Back to England, though. Ben, you mentioned that back three. Mm. And we talked about Stewart under the high ball. But Malins was very good, got involved for the first try. And Watson, you know, coming back into the fold and starting. What difference do you think it makes having three solid ball players as wingers that could all interchange in and around that fullback position?
But I think with the amount of kicking you've got in rugby now, it's not a bad idea at all. Stewart's got the advantage. He's not particularly quick, but he's so big, he's quite hard to bring down. Whereas Watson is probably the next best player in the air in the country, I would say. He has his odd moment, I guess, but you know, but he's just really quick, and he's one player that I think the game seems to speed up when he gets the ball. And then Malins is quick as well and a good ball player, so they all can get themselves out of trouble as well as being good under the high ball.
It's interesting. So just to very quickly, obviously for Watson's try, you know, Ollie Hassell-Collins played the first two games, right? That I don't think Ollie Hassell-Collins scores that try with as much ease as Watson did, or has made it look as easy as Watson did.
I mean, like, I guess we'll never know, but you know, Watson's got a lot more international tries, and he did make it look easy, didn't he? It was just like get in the corner with no fuss. I just think he's, you know, despite his injury problems, he's one of our world class players. So I think if he's fit, he's just got to be in the side. You know, and it's a nice mix because you've got, you know, all out pace there, and he's elusive. Malins can kind of step in as a sort of extra distributor if you need him. And you can use Stewart just to bash holes if you need to.
And England and they did can that. All, yeah. They did that off of first phase. Instead of Lawrence, they used Stewart a couple of times, once on the blind side, I think, straight off of nine, maybe, if I remember rightly. And they definitely used him in that channel instead of Lawrence to create an extra man.
Yeah, for sure. And it'd be daft not to because he's so big. But, you know, I said to someone before the game, this is the England team I would have picked. So I can't complain if it goes wrong, but I'm quite happy it went right. And I think that back three is the three I would pick, with the one exception that I would think about, you know, it's a 50-50 between Malins and Daly for me, if Daly's fit. But I think, you know, the way it's working at the moment, there's no point changing it. And you know, I don't think they will.
No.
Apart from Malins is injured.
Well, yeah. But they bought Johnny May in, haven't they?
Yeah, which is the Alan Wynne-Jones selection of this squad.
Well, as Doug pointed out, we're a couple of players away from ending that, starting the next World Cups with the same people that finished the last one. If Johnny May comes in, there's a couple of other people he mentioned that I can't remember, Billy Villapola and somebody else.
I think the Johnny May selection is as much about who we're playing in the next game and knowing that they have real class out wide and real threats out wide, and as much as a kind of defensive solution as it is an attacking one and a raw-based solution.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because France kick quite a lot, and they aim to sort of push you back a little bit and then force you into a mistake, you know, get bored and make a mistake. And then they've got those players like the two wingers.
Yeah.
And Ramos is berserk, but he does some awesome things as well.
Well, they
want
that broken field space, don't they? They kick to create broken field space.
Yeah, so they aren't going to kick it really for Stewart to compete a lot of the time. They're just going to try and bore them all to death. And it depends, doesn't it? Do you want to sort of match it like for like, in which case maybe you've got the kick chase of May, or do you want to sort of see if you can get a mistake out of them and then let Arundel have a go at it? But it's, I don't know if Johnny May's the perfect answer for either. Great player that he is or was. He's a great kick chaser.
I'm not suggesting he is the right answer.
No, I know you're not, Phil. But there's mistakes in Johnny May nowadays, isn't there?
Yeah. Top kicker in the Six Nations so far is Ntamack in terms of number of kicks in open play. And the fourth highest, I think, is Ramos. which shows you how much they kick. There's no England kicker in the top five.
Yeah, they just keep pushing you back into your 22, and they're waiting for a bad kick or a turnover from someone trying to run it out. And
which is ironic, considering that during the, remember the Autumn Nations Cup or whatever they called it, that's basically all England did. But they didn't, and Johnny May scored that try against
Ireland, wasn't it? I think that tactic looked a lot worse in that tournament because there was no one in the crowd.
Yeah.
So, I think this France tactic, though, is contributing to the fact that they're not finishing games as strong as they have been before, because they're kind of, well, their pack and their centres spend a lot of time running 20 yards forwards, then 20 yards back, then 20 yards forwards.
You say that, but Fiku has been probably one of the players of the tournament, hasn't he?
And he's probably one of the fittest players in the world, which helps. Yeah. But the pack, they're not the fittest pack. And actually, there's a weakness there that potentially England can exploit with them down to their third choice tight head now, with Antonio out injured and Huas doing the predictable red card. That actually there's potentially a weakness there in the pack that we can look to take advantage of.
I think that's right, but they'll probably also quite fancy our front row, especially if they get if any of the originally picked three go off, because got two old boys and a...
Cole has been bossing it in the scrums, though. that's all he does, but Cole is like Gareth Bilkey circa 2015.
I think
you can scrummage anyone off the ball, but don't expect them to walk.
I think DuPont might be looking for him in open play after about 70 minutes, I would imagine. But yeah. I don't know. I think France have looked beatable, which they didn't for much of last year. You know, to be honest, if France play like they did against Ireland, then I don't hold a lot of hope for England, but the other two games, they've not been quite as impressive.
No, they haven't. And they have allowed, the one thing France will allow, they will allow opportunity, and you can get at them defensively. For all of Sean Edwards' great work, you can accumulate points against France. The problem is finding a way to stop them. They're like the Kevin Keegan of international rugby. You know,
that is damned with faint phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, like the 95-96 Newcastle team.
Oh, not the 2000 England team.
No, definitely not.
DuPont, the Phil Neville of rugby.
Oh, there's the podcast title for this evening, anyway. Yeah, so... You know, we'll be interesting to see. The person that I've been very impressed with, and who's made a difference not only at the breakdown but in the way England have approached their set piece, is Jack Willis. The line out peels, the way that England have varied their line out, which has been a bit of an Achilles heel recently, has seemed to have started to fire a little bit. Chessam and Itoje are starting to form a decent partnership, although it was good to see Laws back at the weekend. And we're again starting to have lots and lots of options. What do you feel, as a bit of an expert in this area, who do you see as our, I'm going to call it a back five rather than a tight five and a back row, who do you see as our most prominent and most efficient back five moving forward, you know, from what we've seen so far in this tournament?
Well, I think as much as he might not be hitting the heights that he was hitting previously, you can't really look anywhere further than Itoje as a kind of nailed on in that first place. And similarly, Chessam has been absolutely phenomenal. So when you consider that, you've then got to look at Ludlam has been standout player of the pack for me, and he's got to be there in the team either at six or eight. Willis, as you say, is a point of difference and a massive point of difference. So he needs to be included. And I suppose the question is then, how do you get that balance right once you've got the two of them in there? There's an option if you're playing somewhere where you want a bit more mobility of looking at a Curry Willis Ludlam option with Ludlam playing at eight. Or if you're wanting something that's a bit more kind of traditional back row to go Ludlam Willis Dombrandt, or equally like Courtney Laws on form is absolutely phenomenal. So do you go Laws Willis Ludlam? And I think any of them are viable options. And that's the great thing about where we are. If you roll the clock back to kind of early Eddie Jones days, we picked Robshaw, Haskell, Billy for every game because there really wasn't significant amounts of opportunities and challenge around that. Then we've landed ourselves in situations where we nail our colours to the mast that this is what we're playing. I'd like to see him play around with a few combinations there and just see how relationships work. But to me, it's really nice to see Ludlam getting a run in the team because I've been a big advocate of him for the last 3 or 4 years, and he's really deserving his place in there. He carries well, he tackles well, he's a nuisance on the ground. He's a whole pitch back row player.
He is. He absolutely is. And you know what impresses me most about Ludlam versus a direct comparison with Alex Dombrandt is the hard yards carry, the carrying contact, the leg drive, the pumping. You know, he makes 2 or 3 meters to get that go forward out of nowhere, almost from a standing start, or you know, he's got that ability. What I don't see often enough from Dombrandt is that sort of carry, you know, where he's Dombrandt's often if he's not coming onto it at pace on, you know, the 12 line, I think we discussed this the other week. If he's not attacking that ball in a big highlight carry, he tends to take contact and go to ground.
So I think if you get Dombrandt at 16, 17 as a Colts coach, you look at him and you go, I want you to play 12. And obviously he's been playing eight all the time. His pass to Watson made Watson's try look considerably easier than it potentially could have been. But you're right, he doesn't bring that hard carrying that sometimes you need to tie people in. He's more about running off shoulders, running at gaps, than he is doing those hard carries. So if you play Dombrandt, what you can't do is play Dombrandt and then play two kind of real ground men who aren't going to do the hard carrying work. You couldn't play, say, Curry Willis Dombrandt. It wouldn't work.
No, and I think it pretty much hasn't worked if we've had Curry Underhill Dombrandt or Curry Underhill Billy, for instance, which is why I think Ludlam potentially could be a very good sort of starting eight option for England, and using Dombrandt's skill set to come on. If you imagine bringing Dombrandt and Smith on for Ludlam and or for Willis, let's say Willis, right? Let's say Willis and Farrell go off after 60 minutes, and you've got Dombrandt coming on at 8 with Smith coming on at 10, while still having Lawrence carrying, whilst having the option to go to Slade or another 13. You know, that would petrify defensive more, I think, than Dombrandt maybe starting.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the point is the same for Smith as well. But we're all aware that only works if Farrell goes off.
Yeah. And that has to be the change.
But no, I think you're right that a lot of teams, I think pretty much every team in the Six Nations did a 6-2 split. Well, no, they didn't. England did a 5-3, but there was a lot of 6-2 splits about. And the reason that is because even with a 6-2 split, that means two of your forwards have got to do 80 minutes, which means for Smith and Dombrandt with fresh legs, there's two weak spots and all they've got to do is find them.
And I don't think... Sorry, Ben, are you going to jump in there?
I think Ludlam's been outstanding, but I think he's just a six to his fingertips. I'm not saying he's just a six. I think he did a good job at eight. But I think he's a six to his fingertips. And I think while he's playing so well, just leave him as he is. Leave him at six. I think, kind of almost said it a couple of weeks ago, but for this tournament, I think now Itoje and Chessum both play really well. Leave them as they are. Ludlam, he's nailed down six now for a decent period. I think Laws is just back from injury, so it's perfect to have him on the bench to cover both to a really high standard. And I think Dombrandt has got to now just persevere with him against two really good sides, see how he gets on. And I'm going to bore everyone with this for the next 6 months, but you've got Mercer to come when, as soon as he's eligible.
Yeah,
you've got a real option there at eight. So I think we need to find out what we've got in Dombrandt, and then if as you say, he's a great option off the bench, you've still got that option in the future.
In an ideal world, you've got those two World Cup class players in every position, and if you've got, you know, Ludlam and Laws, you've got Itoje and Chessum and / Laws, you've got Curry and Willis, who can both play six, can both play seven to a very high standard. You've got Dombrandt and Mercer. Then we're looking at Van Poortvliet, and you know, who hopefully will grow. Mitchell will grow. You know, they're not world class nines yet, but they're getting there. Then we've got Ford, Farrell, and Smith. We then have Lawrence. If we can find another, 12. All of a sudden, things start to become extremely rosy.
Apart from up front.
Yeah, front row is a real concern.
If you've got Laws on your bench, you can also, you can have maybe a luxury back rower there. So you could, I mean, what if you had Ludlam, Willis and Mercer, and then you just let Ludlam empty the tank for 60 minutes and then put Dombrandt on at eight and put Mercer at six? I mean,
I'm not sure his tank empties. I've seen him play so many games for Northampton, and he's starting to demonstrate it with England, where in the 75th minute he's doing stuff as well as he does in the first.
But you know, or Willis, you know, but you know, that could be another option as well. But
I think Mercer's shafted his bank balance though, coming back to play for Gloucester when Borthwick's talking about binning the overseas rule, so that he can keep Willis playing.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a real shame, isn't it? That's going to be a choice. But he's still only young, and you know what? Like we talk about. I mean, how old's Mercer coming back, Ben?
I mean,
he's got to be only 26, 27. Isn't
I was going to say 26. I'm just going to Google it rather than guess.
Now, if you're a back row player. Maybe even, you know, even saying a
26th in June.
He's 25, having played, you know, obviously a few years for Bath, gone away playing 2-3 years in France, developing physically, coming back as a number eight in what you would probably say is his absolute prime years, 26 to 30 as a number eight.
Yeah,
probably to 32.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's but not only has he developed physically, he's learned his game, he's understanding his craft. How many times have we criticized England, these young English players for not maybe taking those chances, for not maybe going to test themselves elsewhere? And for all of his faults, right? Where James Haskell took himself to he played for Stade Français, didn't he? He played in Japan, he played for the Highlanders. And when he came back to play for England, he was an infinitely better back row and an infinitely better rugby player for those experiences. I've absolutely no doubt.
So, exactly the same with Martin Johnson. Johnson went and played in New Zealand for two seasons and came back three times the player.
So I'm actually all for, right? At the end of this World Cup cycle, like, let's bear in mind, so if he's staying, Willis is staying in France for 2 years. If he does 2 years ahead of the 2027 World Cup, he could come back, he could play 2 years in France, come back in 2020, start the 25-26 season for wherever he goes. and be an absolute phenomenon? Because Willis is only, what, 23, 24?
Yeah, no, you're right. And he could probably go and play a bit of Super Rugby in between as well.
Well, absolutely.
Or the end of the season. England need to be careful with Zach Mercer, though, because later this year he becomes Scotland eligible and they'll snap him up quickly.
Well, yeah.
Five years since he last played for England.
I can't see. I mean, you'd hopefully that wouldn't happen. You'd think that that would be very much on Borthwick's radar, wouldn't you? And as soon as he's back in the country and eligible, that would very much be something that's top of his agenda. So
yeah, you'd hope he's spoken to him already.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Any other rugby? Any other rugby related stuff? I see that Leicester have got a new head coach this evening.
Don't care.
No, good.
Just quick word on Italy. They are so close to being a really, really good side. Just like that. I saw bits of the game that they were playing. I didn't see all of it. I listened to it, and by God, never listen to Irish commentary on rugby because it is the most biased thing ever. But they've added a bit of grittiness and dog to their defence, and they've obviously got a shit ton full of flair in the backs. And give it another season or so, if they carry on this trajectory, they will not be also ranked in the Six Nations. They'll have a decent chance of turning over any side.
They were good in stages against England the other week.
It's just stringing it together.
Yeah, and that consistency comes with time, and they and coaching, and in general, they are getting much better. They've got a crop of very good young players. I mean, the likes of Ruzza and the fullback whose name escapes me, Ange Capuzzo.
Yeah,
Capuzzo. I mean, he is world class. He's electric.
Yeah, he's injured though, isn't he?
Yeah, but he makes things happen for them, doesn't he? He really does. Yeah. Where they lack, where Italy lack is depth. That's a fact.
They seem to struggle a bit at scrum half, don't they? There's a couple of mistakes in Varney every game. If Garbisi's injured, then they're struggling at 10 as well.
Tomasi Allen's decent enough.
I mean, yeah, he's workmanlike, isn't he? Yeah. And then, you know, the centres have played pretty well. They've got a bit more sort of creativity to them than the Italian. Italy used to quite often have just two sort of roadblocks at 12 and 13, didn't they?
They're starting to offer a bit in attack.
Yeah, they've got a huge amount of back row options, but it's just get it all together for 80 minutes, isn't it? But to be honest, I think if England had to go to Rome, I would have been really worried about that fixture, because I think until Italy beat England, they're going to have trouble beating England, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
They've beaten France.
And it's going to happen one day.
Yeah, of course it will. But they've beaten France already, so there seems to be more belief there when they play France than there is with England, especially at Twickenham. But, you know, I mean, this time last year, people were ready to get rid of them, weren't they? But since they beat Wales, perhaps for the first out of two times, we're thinking, you know, that must have meant the world to them, and they've really kicked on.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Any other rugby-related stuff from you two before we look to wrap it up?
I mean, we didn't meet up after the last round of games, but Ireland-France was absolutely fantastic. You know, I know we don't like to admit it sometimes, but that was just a brilliant game.
The two best teams, a classic test match, had a bit of everything.
I can't see much stopping Ireland now for the Grand Slam.
No.
The counter argument to that is I wasted 60 minutes watching Bath Bristol on Friday night. Which is one of the worst games of rugby I've ever seen.
The one thing I will say about a potential Ireland Grand Slam is that there is nothing better than you know, less than 12 months out, seeing Ireland reach their absolute peak only for them to shit the bed in the World Cup. Like, it's, well, I've probably seen it three times previous, and it's, you know, I can't wait for it to happen again.
It's, they're in the group with Scotland and South Africa, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not easy,
and,
is it?
No, it's not. And that's a, I mean, you know, of all the groups, that's probably the hardest to call, especially the way that Scotland are playing.
So they're going to Scotland, not next Sunday, but, you know, the next Sunday fixture. Yeah. Well, we'll see what that's like. I don't know. Keenan's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And, you know,
their back row at the moment, I mean, their entire pack to a certain extent.
I mean, Doris, I'm sold. And
but I'm not convinced that if the large quantities of glue and masking tape fall off Johnny Sexton, that
yeah,
they're half the side that they are with him.
That's the big question, isn't it? Because I forget his name. He came on at scrum half against France.
Pass.
His name was, I think it might be Casey.
Right.
And he was excellent when he came on. He really made a difference because obviously the starting scrum half is injured at the moment. So Murray was playing pretty well. Yeah. But he came on and really just
Casey started on Saturday against Ireland.
Yeah, I'm talking about in the France game.
Yeah.
So he came on and really made a difference. You know, but so that they've got a bit more depth there. But yeah, fly half, you know, as good as the Byrne that came on has done, it's definitely a step down, and it'd hit their confidence for sure.
They've got, I mean, again, they've got some injuries through this tournament. Obviously, no Furlong, no Healy, no
Beadham now. So Tom O'Toole would be their first choice tight head. Again, they're down to their third choice tight head.
But they just seem to be just churning out this depth.
Do you remember the year England won the World Cup? They, in the Six Nations, they were down to sort of fourth or fifth choice props at one stage.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that proves anything or not, but if you can carry it off and keep going through, then when your first choices come back, it's an even better sign, isn't it?
Well, it just increases the depth, doesn't it? It gives those players experience. It shows them, you know, which always helps with state-funded rugby doping. anyway, that's Ireland. Best of luck to them. Not. Right, let's move on. Let's get out of here, shall we? Any other business, Ben? Anything from you this week?
Just a bit of TV. Predictably enough, Clarkson's Farm, which is just brilliant. It's such a good watch. I mean, I think a lot of farmers, I've heard them say he's done more for farming in this country than in 2 years than Countryfile have done in 25. but, you know, it's very much like Top Gear. You do learn a lot, and it shows how difficult life is for farmers, and there's serious bits in it, but it's also very funny. So much as Clarkson can be a parody of himself, I think when he tries to make something that is informative, he's brilliant at it. So if you haven't seen it, I would recommend it.
You can see in the last episode how some of the situations he's got himself into happen, because he was getting properly riled.
Well, yes.
He was like on the verge of properly losing it, and went, I'm taking myself off before something happens that shouldn't.
There's so many sort of very familiar things in it, and for all that, some of it is probably either recreated or staged. Like there's a bit where they fail a health test, and Caleb is sidekick. The guy isn't a good enough actor to look that worried. if he wasn't genuinely worried. So, you know, there is a lot of truth to it as well. And yeah, it's thoroughly enjoyable.
Excellent. Phil, anything from you?
Yeah, so there's been one thing that's dominated my life for the last 7 days, and that's the fact that my wife had cruciate reconstruction last Tuesday. Cruciate reconstruction, meniscal tidy up, and tagging down what's left of her meniscus. And like, I love having a really active wife until she can't be active. And trying to have that whilst trying to do work, it's been challenging. But she's on the mend now. And I suppose the moral of the story is, if you get injured, get it sorted quickly. Don't wait until it's a proper major job to get it done. But yeah, hopefully we're on the road to recovery now.
Excellent. Get well soon, Mrs. Farm Vet. I don't really have too much this week, so I will give a bit of a TV recommendation. Probably a hashtag late review. It's Yellowstone that I've started watching on Paramount, which is absolutely awesome. Some of the best drama TV series I've watched in a long time. So if you've not tried it yet, get on the Yellowstone. It's very good. Also, something on Dave, which I think it was on BBC for a little while, is World's Most Dangerous Roads. Have you seen it, where they have two comedians just driving the random roads around the world? And it was the one I watched the other week was Keith Lemon and Will Meller driving around some. It was random, but it was very, very funny. So if you get the chance, check out some of those World's Most Dangerous Roads. With it being a fallow week, it's unlikely we'll be back next week. So we'll probably catch up with you in a couple of weeks' time with details and opinions on England-France. And we'll see where we go from there. So we'll see you all very soon. Go well.
Podcast Network.